Here's something that we've been talking about for the last, we've mentioned this word for the last three Sundays. We're going to mention it next Sunday too. No, it's not circumcision, I promise. We're not talking about that. It's the word religion. And here's something that we all know. We know that religion is such a powerful thing, such a powerful entity. Because it's powerful, we recognize that it can also be dangerous. And that can be because most often it winds up in the hands of a very small group of people. Usually it's men. It's often fueled by fear and superstition. But maybe, and I talked about this a little bit last week, maybe what's at the core of what makes religion so powerful is that it's anchored in our consciences. And our conscience is often what drives our behavior. We know that conscience can also be attached to truth. It can also be attached to error. And I said this last week, that our consciences actually determine religious reality, whether they are reality or not, right? Our consciences determine what we consider to be religious. And we've all experienced that in one way or another. You might be with people that do things that kind of bother you, but don't seem to bother them. And you probably do things that don't bother you, but kind of bother them. And why is that? It's because our consciences have been fine-tuned to a certain set of values. And often those are what we experience as religion, right? There are probably things that you used to feel religiously guilty about that you don't feel guilty about anymore. And there are things that you might currently feel religiously guilty about based on, you know, kind of where you are on your religious journey, but that you didn't feel guilty about before. I'll give you an example. I grew up as part of a Baptist church, and I had lots of friends of mine at school who were Catholic. And sometimes my friends would talk to me about having to go to confession. And I just didn't understand it. I had no frame of reference for it. I was like, why do you need to go to confession, right? Growing up in the Baptist church, I was like, you know, just talk to God and tell him you're sorry and kind of move on. You don't need to go anywhere. And they were like, no, I've got to go to confession. And I was like, okay. But their consciences wouldn't let them imagine not going to confession. Meanwhile, Baptists, and forgive me if this hits a little bit close to home, Baptists generally didn't drink alcohol, at least not in the church tradition that I grew up in. It was kind of a big no-no. Certainly wasn't talked about. It was kind of taboo. And my Catholic friends would be like, you don't drink alcohol? Like zero? Like none? And they'd be like, we drink alcohol at church. And I'd be like, what? And they're like, during communion. I'm like, during communion? You guys drink alcohol? And they're like, yeah, we also play bingo. I'm like, you play bingo too? Not during communion. But they'd say to me, why don't you drink? Why don't you drink alcohol? And my answer was, because you're not supposed to. You're not supposed to. And they'd be like, really? You're just not supposed to? But Jesus turned water into wine. And I'd be like, yeah, but it wasn't real wine. I know. I know wine because I'm 8, you know, at the time having this conversation. But it just proves that the way that we are raised and the way religion is presented to you, it fine-tunes your conscience. And that's why I think, and I know from me, that's why this series and the next couple of weeks are going to be a little bit difficult for some of us. And ultimately, whether you're aware of it or not, or are a Christian or not, our consciences have been shaped by a version of Christianity that is a combination of what Jesus actually taught and what the religious model that we've talked about for the last couple of weeks has taught us as well. Our consciences have been shaped or fine-tuned to where we feel the way that we do towards God, that we feel the way we do towards sin, and that we, you know, feel the way we do towards one another because of what we've been taught or what we've caught. And whoever controls your conscience, you know, essentially controls your behavior. And so what we're trying to do as part of this series is separate out the revolutionary way of living that Jesus began from the religious model that we may or may not be aware of has shaped us and is guiding us. And the religious model, I've talked about this for the last couple of weeks, is essentially a way of relating to God that goes back centuries to Egypt, you know, Babylon, Assyria, Persia, certainly the Jewish temple system, the Jewish Judaism, Greece, Rome, and it still exists today, whether that would be in, you know, kind of mainstream religion or in jungles or on mountaintops or in, you know, suburbs and cities. And the religious model always has these kind of four components. There are sacred buildings, you know, place that you go to, where worship takes place in some form or another. Inside that building, there are sacred writings that are often talked about and interpreted, such as what, you know, kind of we're doing this morning. And sacred men, again, I understand the irony of this. It's always men who control or interpret the sacred writings for sincere followers. And, you know, I said that, you know, you might be able to say, you know, or superstitious followers, or maybe even scared followers, or depending on your perspective, maybe even scarred followers. And it might be one reason why some people, maybe some of you here this morning, have, you know, just abandoned religion altogether. And you've walked away from it, including perhaps Christianity, or maybe you're even here this morning and you're like literally hanging on by your fingernails. Because you can see through it all, and you can see that religious model, you know, kind of bubbling to the surface, and you don't want to have anything to do with it. But here is the good news. Here's the good news. When Jesus Christ showed up, he launched something revolutionary. Revolutionary. It wasn't religion 2.0. It wasn't the religious model 2.0, or a version of anything that had existed before. It was a complete change and departure from what existed before. A complete change. And if we've grown very, very comfortable to the point where I say it's revolutionary and you're like, eh, it's probably because our minds, our consciences have been shaped by religious model thinking to the point that we've forgotten how revolutionary, or we've never understood how revolutionary what Jesus did. He said, I've come to do something that's not just geographically located. It's not just for a particular group of people. It's not just for the Jewish nation. It's for all people, for all nations, for all time. And Jesus did not come to rearrange. I was talking to someone a couple weeks ago, and they said, oh, it sounds like you're rearranging the religious furniture. And I'm like, no, 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 that's not what I'm doing, and it's not what Jesus did. He did not come to rearrange the religious furniture. He established a new covenant. A covenant means an arrangement, and Jesus came to establish a new covenant, a new agreement for a relationship between God and humanity, and he gave us a new command. The religious model has lots of rules and lots of commands, and Jesus said, I'm going to give you one command, and it's going to be the filter that you view all the other commands through. And that one command will have an overarching, overriding ethic through which you filter all of the decisions that you make. And you're going to ask a new question. And that question we're going to talk a little bit about this morning, but we're going to talk about it in depth maybe next week. The new question that sort of fuels or helps us live out that new ethic is, what does love require of me? Not what's in it for me, but what does love require of me? When you're not sure of how to live, when you're not sure of what to do, you ask, what does love require of you? And then he launched a new movement, a new community. That's the word, a new community or a new gathering, a new assembly. But in our New Testament version of the Bible, instead of that word being translated as assembly or gathering or community, a German word was that means house of the Lord was inserted into the new Testament translation, the first English translation of the New Testament. And that's the word church, and that's why we think of church as being a place that we go to. But Jesus didn't come to establish a place. On the contrary, Jesus came to establish a new movement of people, open to all people, all generations, forever. A movement where loving others replaced law-keeping, and self-sacrifice would replace the animal sacrifice of most of the religious model. And it's where the vertical relationship with God would not be measured by obedience to rules, but by the depth of the integrity of the horizontal relationships with others. Jesus would actually say, if you're at the temple, if you're at that sacred building and you're making a sacrifice to God because you recognize that there's something wrong between you and God, and it occurs to you in that moment that there's also something wrong between you and someone else, stop what you are doing. Go and make it right between you and the other person. God can wait. And that's hard. For us who probably many of us have determined our relationship with God, that's the only thing, it's the most important thing. And Jesus came to say, you know what? God can wait. What I've done or what I'm gonna do is it's changed things. It's made things different so that you can have that horizontal relationship. That's how you show your vertical relationship by how you live out your horizontal relationships. It's revolutionary. And after Jesus comes the Apostle Paul. And Paul was a product of the religion model, the religious model. And he was initially committed to destroying Christianity, the new movement of Jesus. And on the road to a place called Damascus, where he was going to arrest more Christians, he met Jesus. And he decides he wants to follow Jesus too. And he becomes one of the greatest spokespeople for Christianity. In fact, he wrote nearly half of the New Testament letters. He more than anybody else, because of what initially catalyzed him to destroy Christianity, when he became a follower of Jesus, he realized, you know what? You cannot try to mix or blend the old ways into the revolutionary thing that Jesus had started, because just a little bit of religious model thinking mixed with Jesus has the potential to absolutely ruin it or destroy it. A little of the wrong thing will dilute and pollute the main thing. And he wrote a letter to a group of Christians in a place called Galatia, and we spoke about this last Sunday. Paul said something that confirmed how revolutionary the Jesus movement was. Paul said, the only thing that counts. And remember, this is Paul. He was a Hebrew scholar. He had memorized the Torah, which is the Hebrew religious law. He had taught it. He said, the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love. Don't put your hand up, but I don't know how many of you struggled with the only thing last week based on maybe you know your tradition, what you grew up with, and what you're thinking, and thinking, no, I can't be like that. Paul says the only thing that counts is faith expressing itself through love, specifically love towards other people. He goes on further in another letter to Christians in the city of Corinth, who were both Jewish and Gentile. And the Jewish believers, from time to time, they would go to from where they lived to Jerusalem to go up to the temple to worship. And the Gentiles, who were kind of coming out of pagan ways, where they would just kind of go down the street to worship at their temples, Paul said to them, this is what he writes. He says, do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you've received from God? And I can just imagine, they'd be like, no, but a temple is a place that you go. And Paul was like, yeah, that's the old way. That's the old way of thinking. That's the old version. That's the religious version. Jesus has done something new. You are more sacred than any building or piece of ground that you could put your foot on. You are a portable temple of the Holy Spirit. To which the Jews would say, no, the Spirit dwells in the Holy of Holies in the temple in Jerusalem. Only the high priest goes in there once a year. And Paul would say, yeah, that's the old way. The new covenant has come. the Holy of Holies in the temple is of no significance anymore. It played its role. The curtain was actually torn. As a follower of Jesus, you are a portable temple, and we are indwelt by the same Spirit of God that indwelt the Holy of Holies in Jerusalem. He would say to them, if you forget, and I would say to this to us, if you forget anything or everything else, we are portable temples who gather with other portable temples to put the person next to you, or in front of you, beside you, and behind you, before you. The entire law, Jesus said, the entire law can be summed up in two applications. Love God and demonstrate your love for God by your love for other people. We'll talk more about this next week. That's simple but incredibly demanding, and it is absolutely revolutionary. And what's so great about it is that this new ecclesia, that's the word, ecclesia, the new movement, the new assembling, the new gathering, the church, got off to an amazing start. And they looked at other people like God did as sacred, and that informed everything they did. In fact, a historian named Rodney Stark wrote a book called The Rise of Christianity, and in it he wrote about what everyday Roman citizens who weren't Christians, who weren't followers of Jesus Christ, said about the followers of Jesus. He wrote, they loved so well. Remember, at the time, they were a persecuted entity, a persecuted community, because they wouldn't worship Caesar as the authority. They were persecuted at this time, but they loved so well. Stark writes that they would take in abandoned children, and during that time, because in Roman culture, if a child wasn't healthy, often it could be abandoned, and the Christians, who again were being persecuted by the Romans, would take in abandoned children that were not their own, that were Romans' children's. Not only taking care of their own sick and poor as they did, but taking care of everyone who was sick or poor or needed. And especially during a time when a plague rolled through, the Roman citizens would often, fearful for their own lives, they would put their sick and infirm family members out into the streets. And it was the Christians who didn't fear for their own lives who took them in. They didn't fear death. Why? Because they served a resurrected Savior. And the Greek and the Roman culture just could not comprehend, and no frame of reference for these people who were being persecuted, who would yet love and care for people who weren't their own, and also forgive one another, that they would love and treat everyone as a one another. And at this time, the Christian community, they had no Bible like we do. Right? They didn't have the Torah. They didn't have the Old Testament. All they had were, when they gathered, were the word of mouth stories about Jesus. And about 25 years after the resurrection, then you had Paul's letters that started to circulate. But they didn't have all of Paul's letters. They had, some gatherings would have one or this, and others would have more. There was just this faith that was fueled by love and love for one another. And people that found that they had nothing in common, really, found that in Jesus they had everything in common. And the church grew and it gained traction. So how then, if we take that, how do we get to the place that we talked about in week one, where we sort of are today? How did we get so religious-y? And for many people, how did Christians become so unsafe? Well, the answer is that we held on to things that should have been left behind. And this morning I want to take a very quick look at some of where we've come from, a little bit of church history. And we might see a couple of things that have shaped where we are today or how we've become so comfortable. Let's jump ahead to the 4th century. And at the time when Emperor Constantine rose to power, persecution of Christians was the official Roman policy. Again, because they refused to join what was called the cult of the empire. They wouldn't worship, they wouldn't recognize Caesar as their authority because they recognized Jesus as their king. And in 312, Constantine was on his way to do battle with his co-emperor, Maxentius, to see who would be the supreme ruler of the Roman Empire. And on the road, he has this vision in broad daylight of a cross in the sky. And some historians say he heard a voice or he saw an inscription, and it said, "In this sign, conquer." And so he stopped and he painted the symbol of the cross on many of the soldiers' shields. And he went to do battle against Maxentius, and he was victorious. And the Christians hailed him as a conqueror. And he, because his mom, Helena, had exposed him to Christianity, he expanded his interest in Christianity, and he began to consider the one true God that the Christians worshipped. And the cross became a symbol not of Roman execution, but of the crucifixion of Jesus. And what was birthed, and it gathered steam kind of from that point on, was not the beginning of the Roman Empire, but the Holy Roman Empire. Kind of the problem was it was far more Roman an empire than it was holy. But Christians in that, under Constantine, began to gain status. And a year later, Constantine legalized Christianity through something called the Edict of Milan. And he poured money into the church. And he built buildings, and he elevated the status of the priests and the bishops, and churches didn't have to pay taxes. And so what happened was richer landowners would dedicate their property and houses to God so that they didn't have to pay taxes, and the rich became richer. But very quickly, under Constantine, the Christians, who were once a persecuted minority because they resisted worshiping Caesar, became a powerful majority because it paid to follow Jesus under Constantine. The problem was soon that Christianity became inseparable from the Roman Empire. Church leaders created their own religious model with a little bit of the Jesus movement, Jesus teaching kind of sprinkled in. Now you had sacred places, more sacred places, new sacred places, with new sacred men, and they were the ones who determined what was taught and what wasn't taught, and how the sacred writings would be interpreted. An example of how far that actually went, how, you know, integrated that became, was something called the Arian controversy. Some of you may kind of know about it. It was a theological question around Jesus' divinity. Particularly, did Jesus become God after he was born, or was he born God? Right? Yeah, right? You probably talked about that this morning over your Cocoa Puffs and Rice Krispies, right? This became a really big deal, and it actually caused division within the church, because a church leader named Arius believed that Jesus' divinity was actually given to him as an adult as some kind of a reward for his faithfulness to God. Most of the church leaders, including a man named Athanasius, believed that Jesus was born divine. Now, Constantine wasn't a theologian, right? He was an emperor, and he didn't want there to be any division within his new, you know, Holy Roman Empire. So he organized a meeting, which was later called the Council of Nicaea. And Athanasius led the debate, arguing persuasively that Jesus was born divine, and he won the debate. And out of that debate came what's called the Nicene Creed. Some of you may have heard that. But after the debate, people did not go away friendly or with an increased sense of togetherness or unity. There was still division over differing beliefs and understandings. So, Emperor Constantine doesn't want any disruption, doesn't want any division, so he puts out an official proclamation, and I'm going to read it here because it partly explains why so much of what we still experience today exists. Here's what he said. If any writing composed by Arius should be found, it should be handed over to the flames so that not only will the wickedness of his teaching be obliterated, but nothing will be left even to remind anyone of him. I hereby make a public order that if someone should be discovered to have hidden a writing composed by Arius and not to have immediately brought it forward and to have it destroyed by fire, his penalty shall be death. As soon as he is discovered in this offense, he shall be submitted for capital punishment. And so what happened was theological differences were labeled as heresy and punishable by death. Believing the wrong thing became a crime. And what soon happened in Christianity was what you believed trumped how you behaved. And Christianity became very creed-oriented. And those creeds, if you read them, there's the Nicene Creed, there's the Apostles' Creed. They are absolutely extraordinary and beautiful writings. They state so many things that are incredibly important to theology and to Christianity. But the problem with the creeds is there's no mention of love. In fact, there's no mention of behavior at all. You could agree with everything that the creeds said, but not have to take any action. They were about what you believed, not how you lived. And soon what you had in that mix were Christians arresting other Christians for not believing the right thing, arresting them for their beliefs. And what arose was the church or the Christian model, the Christian version of the religious model. Sacred men became the gatekeepers of your relationship with God, in particular, who got into heaven and who went to hell. And the Pope, the priests and bishops and archbishops became the most powerful men in the land. Even the kings feared the power of church leadership. And then a little bit further on, the 11th century, we have the first crusade that was launched by the Pope. And what he did is he promised all those who signed up to be in the army, the crusaders, he promised that their sins would be forgiven. So all these landowners and these knights, they charge off, and they, I'm not going to get into the detail, but I mean, they performed horrific acts all the way across Europe, all the way to Constantinople and into the Holy Land, where they escalated acts of anti-Semitism, the likes of which we haven't seen in forever, really. And they raped and pillaged Jewish families, because these were men sent by the church to do the will of God. And they murdered and they stole their property and their wealth. Because at this time, nobody had access to the Bible. The sacred writings would be interpreted the way these men thought they should be. And Christianity, this movement characterized by love for one another, almost comes to a screeching halt if it wasn't for the work of a small remnant of the monastics and people who understand what Jesus and who Jesus was and what he was all about. And so, carrying on with that, later in the 15th century, we get the Protestant Reformation. Martin Luther and others, they weren't out to abandon or to destroy the church, but to reform it. That's where you get the name Reformation. But those inside church leadership saw them as protesting. So that's where we get the word Protestant. And Martin Luther was a Greek scholar, and he understood that most of what the church stood for wasn't found anywhere in the gospel writings. There were these things called indulgences, that somehow you could, you know, pay for a brick to build a building, and you could get your loved one out of purgatory or out of hell. The church's version of salvation certainly wasn't in the scriptures that Martin Luther read. The idea, actually, that any of the church's leaders could control who got into heaven and hell was not there. And so he and they began to reform the church, and Martin Luther was actually excommunicated for his efforts. But during this time, the reformers brought several key and important reforms. Solo fide was one of them, which literally means by faith alone, which became the foundation of Protestantism, right? We believe that salvation is not by works, that you can't earn it, but by faith alone in Jesus. And Martin Luther and others began to teach this. And then the printing press was created, and scriptures were being translated into English and made available for people to read. And then the other sola was sola scriptura. The reformers believed, like many of us believe, that scripture, not the church, is the authority for humanity. That's why the reformers were so adamant to get copies of this into every person's hands. Of course, that was a threat to the church and to the religious model, because if everybody had scripture, then the traditions that the church was built on wouldn't be taken as authoritative, and the leaders in the church would lose their authority. But without meaning to, and without knowing where all of this would go, in the hands of the reformers, the Protestant church leaders, even though they were well-intentioned, the scriptures then became the very same thing as the pope, the priests, and the bishop's authority was, as it had been before. Scriptures became a weapon. The reformers did exactly, not intentionally, but exactly what the church had done before. And as a result, the Protestant church split into dozens and then hundreds, and now today I think there's over 3,000 Protestant denominations across the planet. And what divided us? Because some denominations loved better than others or differently than others? Nope. What divided us was the interpretation of the sacred writings. Now, you have sacred buildings with sacred men interpreting the sacred writings, especially what would ultimately allow God to accept people and keep them out of hell. And the sad thing, and I'm a part of this, you know, I'm a Protestant, right? We've been perceived as hitting people over the head with the Bible for centuries. But the real tragedy in all of this is the loss of love. The loss of love. Jesus' commandment to love others was rationalized away. And what we've ended up with is half a dozen versions of the religious model with Jesus sprinkled in. Jesus brought something revolutionary. And instead, for many, it has become religion 2.0. Now, I wonder, in my imagination, I wonder if, you know, wherever heaven might be, if it's up, well, let's just say, okay, it's up, kind of look at heaven, we'll say that. I wonder if Jesus and Paul and maybe Peter ever look out upon the chaos that transpired. And we've just done a very quick tour of centuries of church history. But I wonder if they ever looked and said, what happened? I wonder if Jesus said to them, I don't think I could have been any clearer. I got them all together, and I washed their stinking feet. I told them, this is an example of what you're to do for one another. I looked them right in the eye, and I said, as I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this love will everyone know that you follow me if you love one another. How did it come to this? And maybe Paul says, no kidding, I even wrote mine down. Made copies of it. I sent it out. What could be clearer than this? The only thing that matters is faith expressing itself in love. And then you know Peter. If you know Peter, man, he often spoke before he thought. But in this instance, he says to them both, listen, whatever you do, don't look at what they built over where I'm buried. Whatever you do. If you don't know what that is, that's Peter's Basilica in Rome. It's the largest temple, sacred building, really, I think, in the world. Peter would say, I wrote it down too. Have sincere love for each other. Love one another deeply from the heart. How could something so clear become so complicated? How could the revolutionary movement of Jesus that was so pure, so one another oriented, become so religious. The reason, and this might be really hard for us to admit, for some of us, because there is a little religious model in all of us. There is a little religious model in all of us, and our consciences have been shaped by it. What we fear, what we see as sin, what we think God condemns has been taught and caught so that our consciences have been shaped by it, and we continue to hold on to things that we should let go of that hold us back from experiencing the freedom that Jesus brought. And I know for some, as it was for me when I was looking at this message for this week, is that really me? Some of you might be thinking, well, Dean, you know that maybe that's you, but I don't think it's me. And I'm going to be gentle here, but I think it might be helpful for me to ask us a couple of questions just to show us how subtle the religious model thinking is and how subtle it can be and how it shapes us. Let me ask you these questions. Don't raise your hands, all right? But just think about this. Have you ever wondered how close you can get to sin without actually sinning? Have you ever wondered how close you can get to sin without actually sinning? That's religious model thinking. Because we're not actually trying to get close to God. We're trying to get close to sin, but we don't want to get so close, we don't want to actually tick God off. So we want to know, where's the line that I shouldn't cross so that God doesn't strike me with a lightning bolt, right? When I was a youth pastor, I used to have young people all the time. They'd come into my office and they'd say, so do you think this or do you think that is sin? And, you know, because basically they were saying, like, I'd really like to do this, but I don't want to sin, but I want to know how close I can get to it without making God angry. They never said that, but that's inherent in the question. That's religious model thinking. Here's a second one. How about this? Has there ever been a time in your life when you felt guiltier about missing a Sunday gathering or a Bible study or your devotional time than you did about how you treated somebody at work or at school or in your home? You know? I didn't do my devotions today, and I felt guiltier about that than about how I treated someone. And somehow in your thinking, that Bible study or devotions or those kinds of things take precedence over how it is that we treat other people. If your conscience has been sort of wound up in that kind of thinking, that's religious model thinking. Third question. When or if you failed morally, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of morality, but there was a time in your life where you would say, based on your own standard for morality, that you failed morally and you hurt someone. Here's the question. Were you more concerned about what God would do to you than about what you did to the other person? That's religious model thinking. Because religious model thinking is always self-centered. And the worshiper or the follower is always more concerned about themselves than about other people. Four, do you believe there's some kind of ritual that makes you right with God or redeems you and removes your responsibility to make restitution with the person that you've hurt? Like there's some kind of a prayer or something you can do consistently that will make you right with God and will somehow remove your responsibility to make things right with someone else. I know I'm trying to be gentle, I really am, but that is religious model thinking. Do other people's perceived sins generate feelings of superiority or compassion? Do other people, you know, those people, you know, those fill in the blanks, you know, do other people's sins, what you label as sins, make you feel morally superior instead of breaking your heart? Because that is religious model thinking. Just like in the story that Jesus told of the religious person in the temple who prayed to God and said, God, I thank you that I'm not like them. I'm not like that person, that sinner, right? Is there any of that in you? You know what? I wish it wasn't so, but I recognize those things are in me. There's another one. Do your beliefs or your theology ever get in the way of your love? Do your beliefs or your theology ever get in the way of your love? Do you have views that get in the way of you loving others? I'll be as gentle but as straightforward as I can be. That's religious model pollution. It's a little bit of the wrong thing that has the potential to dilute and corrupt the entire thing. It's in all of us, and our consciences are tied to it. But imagine this. Imagine what our houses, our workplaces, our schools, and our communities would be like if the followers of Jesus, if just the followers of Jesus, were to get up each day and recognize the reality that God is fine with me because of Jesus. Now I'm going to figure out how to be fine with other people so that they can be fine with Jesus too. And I think what actually fuels the religious model thinking in many of us is a failure to embrace the gospel. Right? The good news, the gospel is that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and he died for me and he died for you. And as much as there's a lot of theology in that statement, and as much as, you know, at some point in your life you may have prayed a prayer, when the reality of that truth, that the Messiah, the Son of the living God, died for you, when that gets into your heart, here's what happens. The idea that Jesus died for you will begin to recognize that Jesus is for you. And when we understand that Jesus and his Father are unequivocally for you, unreservedly for you, unashamedly for you, and there is nothing anywhere that puts you outside of the compassionate, incomparable, everlasting, communal, timeless, comforting, patient, freeing, indescribable, abundant, overwhelming, amazing, and irresistible love of God. Nothing. By the way, those words were words that when we asked you a number of weeks ago, what's one word you could use to describe the love of God? That's the words that Nashville Road Community Church said. We recognize his grace has no limit. And once that gets into our hearts and we work it in there, it becomes the context for life. And the love that God has for you and for other people becomes the context through which we understand the scriptures. It becomes the context or the lens through which we interpret the Old Testament and the New Testament and how we relate to God. It goes right back to what Jesus said. You love God and you demonstrate your love for God by loving others. When you're not sure of what to do because you're letting go of the things that have shaped your conscience that are not part of Jesus' teaching, not part of the revolutionary thing that Jesus started, you ask, what does love require of me? Next week, we're going to talk more about that. Jesus said it. The Apostle Paul said it, that the entire religious law hangs on loving God and loving your neighbor as yourself. And what if that characterized you and me? What if it characterized the church? Not just, you know, the church in general, but what if it absolutely characterized Nashville Road Community Church? What if God's love for us and those around us informed our consciences and shaped our behavior? And when that happens, as I know that it is happening, they will know we are Christians by our love. So I want to encourage you, don't miss next week. We're going to talk about the practical implications of asking the question, what does love require of me? And also this morning, I know there's probably some questions that pop up. We've got these little cards at the back that don't, you know, you can put them online if you want, but definitely if you've got a question this morning, don't leave before writing it down and putting it in the manila envelope, because we're going to try and find ways to answer some of these through the next couple of weeks, but definitely when we do our dialogue gathering at the end of the series. One of our goals in this series is to help us experience the freedom of a relationship with God by stripping away the religious model thinking that we've gotten really, really comfortable with, so that we can again engage on this revolutionary thing that Jesus began, a totally different way of relating to God within the context of a new covenant that said, your sin and the separation that it brought is paid for. It's gone because of Jesus' death and resurrection. Now, live a life that reflects the love and forgiveness of God as you mirror that compassionate, incomparable, everlasting, communal, timeless, comforting, patient, freeing, indescribable, abundant, overwhelming, amazing, and irresistible love in how we treat others.